We're gonna bring Chad out, and our opening line is, we have no idea what he's gonna say, and we're sorry ahead of time.
Welcome to Hallway Conversations. We're a trio of educators who have plenty of questions about teaching and learning and school culture, and we believe in the value of reflection and collaboration as we seek to keep growing as teachers. This podcast is our place for thinking out loud together about issues in education and why they might matter to Christian educators. Welcome to the conversation.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 106th episode of Hallway Conversations. My name's Matt Beamers.
I'm Abby DeGroat.
And I'm Dave Mulder.
Friends, we want to say thank you to our sponsors at CASE, the Center for the Advancement of Christian Education. To learn more about the different ways that CASE can support your school board, leadership team, teachers, or community, we encourage you to visit their website at www.case.org. That's www.cace.org. Also, the Dort Masters of Education program will be hosting a free webinar on March 27 at 7 o'clock Central Time with Dr. Owen Webb on restorative practices, and you'll be able to register for that in the upcoming weeks, and we hope you join us. Today in the hallway, we have a special guest, our friend Chad Dirksy. Chad has served in Christian education for more than 25 years in roles that include math and science teacher, I'd love to be in that class, coach, athletic director, principal, head of school, president, and board member. He is currently the head of school at Annapolis Area Christian School, where he serves more than 870 students and 100 staff. Prior to his current position, he served as the president of Chattanooga Christian School and superintendent at Westminster Christian School in Illinois. Chad has an undergraduate degree in education from Covenant College and an MBA with a specialization in school leadership from Laterno University. He often speaks regularly to school groups about school sustainability and a vast array of educational topics. Chad, want to say thanks for being here today. We invited you to join us to talk a little bit about recruiting and retaining teachers, a topic that seems most people are having conversations about in their school communities. And if they're not having conversations about it, they probably should be. Before we do any of that, I have one quick question that has nothing to do with education. In getting to know you, Chad, I've seen this. You love the Dave Matthews Band. So two questions. Can you tell us about how many concerts you've been to and why Dave Matthews? And then can you just share a little bit about yourself and maybe even your journey into school leadership and why retaining, recruiting teachers is just an important topic to you?
That's a lot of questions wrapped up in one sentence there, Beamers.
Good thing you are so smart.
Well, I just want to say it's a privilege to be here. I've been kind of jealous of all your guests on the show for a long time wanting to be on here because you all do a great job. And I was saying a little bit earlier that I was in Indiana yesterday, and somebody that was in part of a group we were working with said, hey, I heard you on a webinar. And then I said, yeah, I'm going to be on this podcast. And they're like, oh my gosh, you're going to be on that podcast? Why did you get picked? So I felt like I was really important because
this is a big deal.
wow.
Yeah. Really, really big deal to be here. But yes, I am my wife and I are very, very big Dave Matthews fans. We like improvisational music, and we love going to concerts multiple times, like a weekend Friday, Saturday show. The Saturday show is completely different than the Friday show. And, that's kind of the kind of ethos and kind of identity of the Dave Matthews Band. So we've loved them. We've probably been to 50 plus shows.
Wow.
For our 10th anniversary, we went up the West Coast and went from Shoreline Amphitheater to the Gorge in Seattle. It was one of those kind of bucket list trips. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. The first thing I hung in my office in Annapolis was a concert poster from the Dave Matthews Band. So of all the other things that are on the wall, like, you know, diplomas and pictures of my kids, the first thing that went up was Dave Matthews. So that'll tell you something right there. But
something.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, I'm a Christian school lifer. I started in kindergarten and pretty much never left. I wasn't sure when I graduated from high school. I had this kind of poke in the back of my head, you need to be a teacher. But like a lot of high school graduates, I thought, no, I'm not going to make any money doing that. I can't support a family. I'm going to go be an engineer. And then And then I took calculus my freshman year. I'm like, yeah, I like math, but not this much. So I answered that poke in the back of my head and said, hey, let's try this. And I love middle school students, I'll be honest. If I was going to go back and teach, I would choose that 100 times out of 100. The highs with middle school students, in my opinion, are the highest that you experience in the teaching pathway. And now there are the lows that come with middle school students too. But that to me makes every day different. And that's what I would do if I wasn't doing this. I would be a middle school math teacher and having a really good time. Maybe I'll go back and do that someday when I don't want to do this anymore. But that's my background.
Hey, China.
The highs and,
sorry, go ahead,
I was going to say, the highs and lows of middle school also apply to parenting, I'm discovering. Yeah.
Oh, so true. Yeah. Although I thought parenting middle school kids were difficult, and then I had grown children.
Yeah.
And I know it's depressing for people that have younger kids, but I start to wonder if it's more difficult parenting children once they're out of their home, your home, than when they're in it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not what your old experience is going to be, but that I love my kids. They're awesome, but it's complicated.
Yeah.
It's complicated. That's a good word. It's complicated. Hey, Chad, I have not been involved in school leadership as long as you have, because you are a little bit older, or significantly older than I am, but I'm old enough to remember when we would get more than enough, like dozens of applications for one position. There were just so many applicants. And then somewhere along the line, something began to shift. Suddenly it seemed like the pipeline began to thin out. Now the pipeline almost feels non-existent for many principals. We held our first job fair at Dort this year, and it filled up very quickly with schools wanting to come here and interview and even offer contracts to our teachers. Some of them even before they've student taught. Some parents I've talked to told me that it's hard to encourage their children to go into teaching, and some even try to talk them out of it. And I've heard you talk about the need to change the narrative around being a teacher. I've heard you use the phrase, we need to revere the profession. And you also said we need to change the narrative and challenge the public discourse on teaching. Can you just talk a little bit about what you mean by that? Changing the narrative, like, have you seen that in your own work? And how do we go about changing that narrative? So not just in a way that recruits teachers to our schools, but to the profession.
Yeah, I want to start with saying, look, the reality is that the central point of all that I do is to unencumber teachers in the exchange that happens on a daily basis with the students they serve, right? As an administrator, that's fundamentally my job. Because if I'm adding a burden to them, then I'm creating a barrier to the quality that happens in that relationship that is formative, right? We believe education is formation. So it's a wonderful profession, because on a daily basis, you know, through the power of the Holy Spirit, as bearers of his image, we get to participate in this rich thing that's happening as our students grow more and more into the people that God's created them to be. And God's just not saying be a babysitter in that process. As my image bearer, I'm going to invite you into active, purposeful work in that. Now, how much more valuable endeavor could there be than that? That's all true. I believe that with all my heart. That's fundamentally why for 30 plus years, this is what I've chosen as a vocation. I think that I would say there's lots of reasons for this, and we don't have time to get into all of them. But when I saw this change, it really started prior to where I really saw this change in a way that made me start to panic. So when I think about the things in leadership that keep me awake at night, and there's not much that keeps me awake, but in leadership of schools, this is the thing that causes me to panic, is this massive gap right now between the number of positions that are open and the number of candidates that are in the pipeline. And that's, we saw that, right? I've been in Christian schools all my life. I have great friends and love the work that's done in public education. I don't want to disparage that in any way. As a Christian educator, I want to encourage it. We've seen that in our brothers and sisters that have been in public schools a little bit sooner, right? We could see that unfolding in public education a little bit more. But about 6 to 7 years ago, you started to see that thing that was way in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. It started to creep closer. Mm-hmm. And then what happened, I think, in 2020, Right. I try to blame everything I can on COVID, but something around there. And I think COVID was just an accelerant that increased the volatility and the divisions within our culture. And because education is formative, a lot of fingers pointed at the institution of education, whether that's K-12 or higher ed. Everybody wants to find somebody to blame now and somebody to put on the other side of the enemy line, and education got put in the crosshairs. And then it went from broadly education to actually talking specifically about teachers in ways that were disparaging, and in an instant information environment where people can make comments that don't have to be based in any level of fact. At some point, you just started to see this stream of negative stories about what was happening in schooling. And why would a young person now want to get into that, right? I'm going to make less money than I would over here. We have labor shortages everywhere. You're going to get a signing bonus to go work at Jimmy John's, or you're going to be a teacher, right? That may be a false binary, but the reality is the scales got really out of balance. And there still are some areas where schools are getting good volumes of candidates, but there are all kinds of areas around the country where, you know, it's a struggle, and the intentionality that we have to put into our HR systems to just attract and recruit potential candidates that are mission appropriate, that are passionate and love Jesus, and really good at their craft and want to learn and grow and develop. That's a lot to ask people. And then, right, we've also changed, right? We've recognized there are some things that we've done in education in my 30 years, for example, how we serve a wide array of students on the basis of ability. That looks really different today than when I was at Covenant College in 1985. The way you're training teachers to differentiate is very different than the way I was trained in 1985. So we're asking them to do a lot. They have a lot of kids in their classrooms. You see what I'm saying? So all those things together, I think, are the catalyst that pushed this. I think it's a crisis. I think the shortage of teachers, I don't think it's an overstatement to say it's a crisis.
John, what are teachers' roles, or do teachers have a role in encouraging young people to go into the profession? How can we be part of this solution, I guess, is what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I'll use a personal story. I mean, that part of the poke in the back of my head to be a teacher was I had really wonderful teachers that said, hey, Chad, even though you're really difficult, we think you should try teaching. My parents would laugh at that because they're like, you're getting in all this trouble and now you think you're going to go do this job. But my point is, there was people there that while I was being a jerk, that may be what God specifically gifted and called you for. But yeah, I think that current teachers play a huge role in the capacity. And it's not always your typical student, right? It's not always the extrovert who's the one that makes the most noise and answers all the questions. We need a whole host of different types of people to be in the educational profession. And I think that's a good starting point. But if we don't revere the profession as a nation, right? And I'm just talking here. I know, Beamers, you're from Canada, and I don't want to even talk about that. I'm just saying I only know the U.S. And I just think we as a nation need to do a better job. That sounds like a big task, but we can boil that down. We in our churches, we need to do a better job of encouraging and revering the profession of teaching one little step at a time, to get back some sense of this is really good and important work. It's good it's in the best interest of the common good. It's also good for you, right? There's a fulfillment that comes that way outpaces some of the more complicated aspects of teaching.
Yeah. Dave or Abby, you want to jump in on any of that or go a different direction even?
I'm thinking about this question, Chet. Like, I really appreciate what you said about how it's harder to get people, there's a role of revering the profession. That's really great language. Thanks for that. And I guess I'm just thinking about this now, maybe in the sense of, if we're trying to hook great teachers, young people who are coming into the profession, and trying to plug them into a school. What do you think? You get to talk with a lot of school leaders and get all over the place. What do you think young teachers are looking for when they're thinking about where to teach. These are the folks maybe who are, we've hooked them somehow. We've got them into the profession. They want to do this. Are there things that schools might be able to do that make them more attractive for novice teachers coming into the profession? Are there practices maybe that school leaders or even teachers in the schools could be or should be thinking about to try to attract people in to their school?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think there's a lot of ways to go with that. I say this often, there are obviously differences in generations, right? Gen Z, Gen Y, Gen X, we all have these kind of different characteristics. One of the things I appreciate about this generation of people that we'd be encouraging into this profession is they value substance. And to some degree, I think they've also, because they're the ones that isolation is the closest in the rearview mirror in terms of those days where it's also hard, right? Being a middle school kid, being a high school kid can be difficult anyway. And then you throw isolation in the mix of that. They also realize there's something wrong with the current patterns. And that combination of there's something wrong, something's awry, and I want substance. I think teaching is very attractive to people who recognize that, because you have an ability to influence what's wrong or what's broken in a positive way, and you want that to be substantive. And I think we can build on that, right? We can open doors. One of the things that I appreciate about, as I've watched kind of the growth of Teaching for Transformation, for example, which I think is a great process, is this emphasis on beautiful work. I think the more we emphasize beautiful work, the more that's going to attract people who produce beautiful work to want to help other people produce beautiful work. Does that make sense? So I think there's some of the things that we just do that are good educational practice, that if we're focusing on, look at the product, look at what comes out of all of these inputs that are formative, and look at what we're actually capable of producing, I think that inspires people too to say, hey, I want to be a part of that going forward.
That's great.
Chad, I'm wondering if, so I have a niece who's a new teacher. I know Matt has daughters who are new to the profession. I'm thinking about, after all that work of retaining or recruiting, how do you as a principal see your role in retaining those early teachers, especially considering that teaching is hard. It just is, especially year one, year two, dealing with students, dealing with parents. We see it in our grads as well as they student teach. They are, and it's trial by fire in a lot of ways. How can you encourage other school leaders, or how do you maybe approach supporting new teachers so that we can keep them in the field long enough for them to develop their craft and become really good teachers?
Yeah, I think there's two really critical things in my opinion. And again, this is my limited opinion. I think it's really critical, particularly for this generation, that we have to articulate on a regular basis the particular value that new teachers are bringing to our communities. Mm-hmm. Not just say, hey, we're glad to have you. You have good energy. Not just that. We need to say there are things that you understand, things that you contribute that are substantive and can help us move the needle in terms of school improvement, right? That's aimed at the thriving or flourishing of our students. So again, I brought this up. One example of that is our training programs. There is the science of education, the tactical practices. I think we're better at that than we were before. I think that's just part of growth. And I think young teachers today have been trained in some really good practices and some really good ways, particularly at places like Dort, that are a huge benefit to schools, communities that have populations of teachers that have not been trained in those ways. So our new teachers are capable of contributing to professional development within our school communities, because they're freshest out of those best practices. So I think, A, we have to affirm that generation in particular, you're not the newbie that we're just going to turn a blind eye to all the mistakes that you make when you're a newbie. You're actually going to be making us better because of who you are, because of how you've been trained. I think that's number one. The second piece is, again, this is hard because it's difficult to do practically, but professional development has to be incremental and it has to be shoulder to shoulder. And right, incarnational is day by day. It's not, oh, we've got this PD day coming up in 6 weeks, right? That's good. I'm not saying we shouldn't have those. I'm saying we have to be intentional about how professional development is happening day by day in those real moments, in bite-sized pieces that allow them to try and fail and pitch, take this and apply this and pitch this, right? But not filling them up all in one day. The model historically of PD is we've got these special days and we do it all. Somehow we've got to find a way practically to build into our infrastructure the recognition that that needs to happen on a regular basis. Because it's sweet relief, right? When I'm struggling, I remember sitting in a teaching science methods class, and I'm 57, so this was a long time ago. And it's the first time I ever heard anything about Bloom's taxonomy. And I'm looking around the room and I'm like, I do not understand a word she's talking about. This makes no sense to me. This might as well be Greek. Mm-hmm. And as she keeps talking about this class after class, now I'm fearful to go to class because I don't understand a single thing she's saying. It doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm looking around and it seems like everybody in the class knows exactly what she's talking about, except for me. Well, then finally, some other courageous person raises their hand and says to the teacher, I get we're supposed to know this, but I do not understand how this applies. This makes no sense to me. And I remember like it was yesterday, the relief I felt that somebody else felt the way I do. Mm-hmm. Well, we're day by day when we do professional development. Well, it's not just we're filling their heads with good practices and good ideas. We're actually restoring their souls because we're helping them see we have to learn together and we have to learn day by day. I don't know if that makes sense, but those two things to me, valuing the contributions new teachers make and doing that intentionally and articulating that well, and then making sure we're committed to shoulder, day-by-day professional development. Those are the two things that I think are most important to retain teachers, because I think then that naturally communicates that we care for them. Now, I think compensation is important too, and I think we've got some significant work to do there. Typically, when we want to make tuition charging schools cheap or affordable or accessible to parents, we have a tendency to do that all in the back of faculty. Because if we have to hold costs down, that's 80% of our budget. So, we don't want this parent to feel the financial stress of a larger tuition increase. Well, then that suppresses income for teachers and that creates a whole nother dynamic. So we could go off on that tangent too, but right. I think those two things are most important.
Yeah. Thank you.
I want to come back to that in a bit, actually, Chad, because I would love to hear more in a bit about some of the compensation structures and the relationship between recruiting and retaining teachers, especially coming out of a place many years ago where if you even asked about money, you didn't have a strong sense of calling or you weren't committed. Yeah. But I just want to come back to something you actually said way at the beginning in terms of, hey, like, I think you used something like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, like part of my work here is to not add any burdens to teachers and what they're doing. And what do you think are some of the, maybe unbeknownst to school leaders, some of the other potential burdens that they put into place to either, hey, making their schools attractive or burdens they put in place that might drive teachers away once they're there? And I'll just give you one quick example. Was I have two daughters who are in their first couple of years of teaching. It was unbelievable to me looking at some of the application packages that they opened up that essentially they just closed because it's like, this looks like a six-hour job. And I know that it's like that, the application process is important, but even for them, it was like, oh, like this is a huge barrier. So I'm thinking about whether some practical examples of recruiting and retaining barriers that schools might put up without knowing it.
Yeah. And I don't want to suggest that I'm really good at not putting barriers in place. No. 'Cause you could bring some people on that have worked for me that could tell you a whole different story, I'm sure. I do think that piece that you told there, I'm a strong believer that when we post openings, we should be asking for a resume and maybe two faith questions just to check the box to say, hey, there are some non-negotiables here. Read this statement of faith and make sure you can support this. But for the initial application, that should be it. Mm-hmm. At AACS, we just worked through, we had like a 4-page document for every posting. And then it said preferred characteristics on one page. And we're all sitting in a meeting and we're all of us who are leaders have been in this for a long time. We're like, well, if I read that, I would say I'm not qualified for that job. So I think that we have to find ways to get to the things that are essential for us to know before we make a hire. We've got to figure out how can we do that as efficiently as possible. We have to assume that the people that are applying for our positions are essentially cross-apping us with 5 to 6 other places who are going to offer them a job. So they're going to make their judgments in part about how we were thoughtful in the hiring process and the work we required from them. Like one of the things that schools are oftentimes not very good at is you fill out an application and then you got to fill out this thing and then you got to fill out this thing and you got to fill out your name, address, and telephone number 14 times in the process of recruiting and onboarding. Well, again, we're serving a population of people that are like, that isn't necessary. We know there are systems that can reduce that redundancy. Why are you still doing this? I think this is a whole nother subject, but I think schools have to invest in quality HR departments. We can't just assume that principals that have been teachers that went through a master's program fully understand the nuances of human resources. We have to have professionals that can do that well. When salary negotiations happen, we have to have people that know how to do that. So you're caring for someone and you're also holding the needs of the school in check. But when I graduated with and became a leader for the first time, I didn't know any of that stuff. I didn't learn that in my undergrad. I touched on it in the master's work I did, but not enough to be an expert in it. So that's another part of it too. But I think that part of unencumbering teachers is to be transparent, create optional opportunities to be transparent about what's happening in our school communities and give them access to what's behind the scenes. Let them see why things happen. Not to say they have to be heard on every single subject. They just have to have the comfort that somebody is being thoughtful about how these decisions are made. And then the age-old adage of, y'all, we have to monitor the change we're asking them to make. Because what makes sense in our heads when we're the ones that aren't in a classroom every day doesn't necessarily make sense to them when there's 10 other things we're asking them to do that's different than what we asked them the last year. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No. Dave or Abby, any follow-up or questions or?
I'd love to come back to the compensation question if you're comfortable, Jed. Tell us a little bit. The relationship between compensation structure and teacher retention. I mean, I suspect there probably is a link there at your level of comfort, but if you don't mind, share with us some of your thinking on that.
Yeah. And again, first of all, I think we all know compensation is not everything. No one gets into this profession because they think they're going to be rich. Let me rephrase that. Monetarily rich. I think we get into this profession because there's a richness of the work we do. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, y'all, we have to be thoughtful and acknowledge. We just have to be honest. This is one thing that I think every school has to do. Every school that uses a salary structure that's based on years of service and degree, we have to admit that when we have openings and the scarcity of openings and a teacher comes in with 3 years experience and we don't have anybody in the pool and they say, I'll come for this wage, but not this one, we put them at 10 years because we got to pay them enough to get there. That to me has no integrity. That creates cynicism within the way we view compensation as a measure of value. So let's just be honest and let's just say this is a hot mess. Some of the struggles that we're facing in compensation right now is we have really faithful people that have been here for 20 years and we're trying to fill openings that we have a very small number of candidates for. And the market is driving an income for that new teacher that is pressing us in some cases beyond what that more experienced teacher is getting paid. And we can't have classes that are unfilled. You see what I'm saying? So if I have a math opening for high school math, I can't not have a high school math teacher. So if I have a candidate that's saying, well, based on your salary structure, you would get paid X, I'm willing to come for $10,000 more than that. We have to be honest. We have a fiduciary obligation to put a good math teacher in that classroom. That's the pressure that we face. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you're always going to pay that person $10,000, but there are going to be circumstances where you are. So the system of compensation that's based on years of degree or years of service and degree it's not functional in the world in which we live. Now, it was created for very good reason, and, and it was around the sense that teaching is a profession. So it added to the professional characteristics of the role and function itself. I think there are other banded options that allow you to have less, right? If the vertical bands, right, are years of service, and the horizontal bands are degrees. Does that make sense? You can create less of those bands that can be broader, that are vertical kind of categories, like a brand new teacher. Some of us are having to hire teachers that aren't fully credentialed. So you might have a salary band for that teacher in that 0 to 3 years of service range. Then you might have that intermediate range. Then you might have a professional range, and then you might have a master teacher range with different kind of qualifications of how you get in those bands. And then as you're moving through, there's a teacher, maybe you're here's where the performance component comes in. You're not meeting expectations, you're meeting expectations, or you're exceeding expectations. That would be more of the horizontal band. Recognizing that, again, using the math example, that there is a difference between a math teacher who goes and gets a master's in mathematics and a math teacher that has a master's in athletic administration. For the value of the overall school experience, it's not the degree itself, it's how is that advanced education actually promoting student flourishing? Because ultimately, that's what we're aiming at. So you see what I'm saying? So you have to allow for the fact that not all degrees are the same. Not that we're not encouraging people to be lifelong learners or math teachers that want to be athletic directors. That's a good pathway. And we want to be sending agencies and developing agencies to allow that to happen if that's what someone feels called to. But as we think about compensation, all those things have to be wrapped in that.
That's great.
Hey, Chad, I'm thinking about teaching in the school leadership program at Dort, and have spoken to people in the past who have wanted to stay at their school and grow as leaders, and the opportunity either wasn't given or presented, or they weren't tapped on the shoulder. And I'm just wondering about this idea about growing leaders within as a way of also retaining teachers at the school. Like, just, I don't know, like how, because there's a leadership shortage too. And I'm just wondering maybe how you went about doing that, or how might Prince school leaders going about do that? Like I said, like how do we raise up leaders as one way to retain good educators?
Yeah, I think I want to say this first. I think we need to create compensation pathways for that person, male or female, who says, hey, I'm interested in school leadership. And we say, yeah, well, we'd be interested in helping you grow in that area. However, we also think you're a great teacher. If you're making this decision because you think this is the better pathway to some sustainability of income that is actually a wage you can live with, we've got to be prepared to pay more to those teachers, right? There's a lot of really good teachers who became administrators because there was more money in it, that what we should have done is inspired them to stay in teaching and see if we could create pathways to make more money in that regard. That's a whole other story. But the reality is we need to be committed to being sending agencies, because there's probably a big pool of people within our school communities that are thoughtful about development and growth into more substantial leadership positions beyond what they do in the classroom. We've got to find avenues that are intentional and thoughtful about giving them access to things that will help them see whether that's what they're called to. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm about providing, I want to be able to provide as practical examples. Whatever you think about accreditation processes, one of the ways that you can plug people in to opportunities to see if they want to be leaders is tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, we want to send you out on this accreditation visit. They're going to build relationships with others that they didn't have before, because they're going to be in a room with 5 or 6 other people from different schools that they're going to get their contact information, and they're going to talk with. They're going to see what other schools are doing. They're going to be open to other opportunities that are in other schools that aren't yours, because that big pool of people within the school I'm at, if I have 200 employees and 20 of them want to have some opportunity to grow, that there's no clear that they don't know what the ceiling is, I don't have enough leadership positions for all those people, right? It's ridiculous to think I can grow every leader to stay at our school. I've got to be connecting them to other school communities And again, having them be on accreditation visits is the cheapest, best way to make that happen. There are lots of other opportunities, but that to me is a great example that I don't think we take advantage of enough.
Oh, that's good. Chad, when I heard you speak a couple of weeks ago, you talked about the need to balance autonomy, agency, hierarchy, and structure. I'm just wondering if you can talk about those words, how we identify if they're out of balance, and what's the relationship between that and teacher retention.
I really said that. I don't even know what any of those words mean.
Well, we can edit this out. We can edit this out. You're so good. You don't even remember what you said.
No. I think that one of the challenging things that I think is really difficult to balance, right, is let's say I'm in a school that has three sections of third grade. There is a real sense in which there is some level of consistency that's valuable between those three third grade sections. But if we package that too tightly, then we remove the capacity of that teacher to demonstrate their individual gifts within that small community. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. The structure and the agency needs to be balanced appropriately, mm-hmm. right? It is appropriate to say, like in a math class, we want the major assessments to be the same so that we can use that assessment for learning, right? Not just assessment of learning, but assessment for learning, and not just for learning of the student, but learning of me as a teacher, the teaching team as a group, and then the whole school. So there, that to me is a delicate balance that I'm not sure in the world, in the sphere of education, we've mastered. And I think there are some of us that have done that better than others. And we need to learn more from each other in that. Then there's also the hierarchy that's scaffolded, right? What happens in math in first grade impacts what happens in 10th grade. Mm-hmm. So we've got to figure out how to build in that infrastructure where even one of the benefits of all of my school leadership experiences were in K-12 institutions, the ability to have math teachers from kindergarten through 12th grade gather somewhat frequently to talk about what that scaffolding looks like was really, really important. And where we fell off most was where that didn't happen, right? Where there wasn't clarity about, well, what do I do if I have this class that's more difficult? And right. We didn't progress through our units the same way we did the year before. Where does that information get put, and who talks about that? And how does the teacher after and the teacher before, how do you juggle all that to make sure we're doing everything we can to put the student in the best situation to flourish? So I think that's a really difficult thing. And I think that deserves more attention in terms of attracting and retaining teachers of how, of course, we want when we walk in a classroom, if I go to all three third grade classrooms, I want to see the uniqueness of that teacher manifested in that classroom, right? And I want to see the big picture, right, infrastructure that says we're all doing the same thing together. Mm-hmm. We have to balance that both. And maybe it's just me. I don't feel like I've done a great job of emphasizing both of those things and putting practical structures in place to make sure those are celebrated, because I hear so many teachers that have left because they believe that all their personality has been removed from the process of teaching and learning, because they've just got this, they got this packet of stuff they got to cover, right? And that's all that matters. And I don't, again, I think education is incarnational and it's redemptive, and our personalities are part of that redemption. So we don't want to remove that from the process. I just don't think we've done a great job of that. And the better we do at it, the more we're going to retain teachers that are really good at what they do.
I think that's a really good point, too, when we see more and more curriculum being packaged and given to teachers as a script, right? So we've had student teachers who've experienced that in math classrooms or in reading classrooms when there are high stakes, who it doesn't feel like teaching when that's the case. And that makes me really sad, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on the flip side, we do need to be able to have open, authentic conversations to say, hey, to a wonderful group of kindergarten through fifth graders, hey, we don't all need to have a Puritan unit in November so we can have a Thanksgiving feast. Y'all can have the Thanksgiving feast, but you don't all have to do a Puritan unit. We're doing a great job of teaching the Puritans, but we're missing a whole bunch of other history. Right. You see what I'm saying? We do need to have both. Yeah. And again, y'all, I just think that's a human enterprise. I think that just requires us finding time to sit across from each other and acknowledge the tension and collectively try to find a way forward.
It's a good word.
I just think it's really helpful because I, like, as you're talking, right, for sure, there's a school leadership component to this, but I think there's a school board component to this. I think you could share this with an education committee for schools that still have education committees. It's for school teachers. It's for parents. Like that. That's why for me, like one of the more powerful things is the changing the narrative. I really do think it's like, even at like, I am super conscious of that. Having daughters who are teachers now, how they hear me talking about teaching before they went into the profession, but even now that they're in the profession, right? Like, how do I talk about it in such a way, honestly, but also like, hey, I've been doing this for 30 years and I love it still, but it's hard work. I'm super conscious of that. They're listening to that through teacher ears now. Right. So,
And for a lot of the schools y'all serve, you talk about the education committees. One of the biggest attractors to teacher retention is the fear that there's this group of people who don't know much about education. They're just on this committee because they're parents in the school I teach in, and they get to talk about me.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, where else does that get to happen? You know what I'm saying? It doesn't make, it's just bad.
That's weird, man.
Just really bad practice. And that's why I tell people all the time, part of what I do with development is get rid of, board should only have two committees, finance and executive committee, and hire people that can run the operations, right? We're parent-owned and professionally operated. And get an HR function that can care for faculty well, right? I need to be able to say to somebody, hey, I got to have this hard conversation with you because we need to see some improvement, or there maybe have to be some adverse action. But you know what? It's possible that you're going to experience this in a way that I don't intend. And you have a person that you can go to that's going to be your advocate. And here's the HR person. This person does not have any direct reports. They have a right to tell me I'm not doing this the right way. And if you go to them, they don't have to tell me everything you talked about with them. They have to create those spaces because we don't get it right all the time. I mean, again, think about this. We don't spend enough time. This isn't going to sound like a criticism of Dort Master's program. We don't spend enough time on the actual people management parts in administrative preparation programs. And we're so bad at this. I mean, so many teachers have been harmed because, you know, the number of times I hear from people that the day they were supposed to get their contract is when they got a whole laundry list of people, things from their boss that they weren't doing well, that's still happening within our school communities. You just can't do that. There should never be a surprise in an annual review of a teacher. That should never happen. Now that sounds like common sense, but I'm telling you, that ball is being dropped so often in our schools.
I'm now wondering about like teacher evaluation systems and teacher retention and in the actual the system itself that just leads people to be like, you know what, if this is what this is about, then I'm out. And so I'm just wondering, in your mind, what's an effective teacher evaluation even look like? And like, maybe how are you doing that different than 20 years ago?
Yeah, the hard part is I haven't evaluated teachers in 20 years because I'm a head of school in a school that has multiple layers of leadership.
Yeah. Well, what would you say to current principals to say, hey, like if you're doing this, you might need to to rethink it or reimagine it?
Yeah. And again, I think we just have to create micro spaces for appropriate feedback, right? Wow. Teachers have to get comfortable with us giving them affirmation and suggestions. Wow. And that's hard. I get it. Right. So I think sometimes we have to rethink our administrative structures. And again, for schools that want to be cheap, you know, and again, Dutch reform schools typically have the lowest tuition rates. Right. And that means they got to save money somewhere. So So I'm working with a school right now that has 500 students to have one principal, period. That principal does everything: fundraising, interviewing, educational leadership, all that stuff. Well, there's no way that person has the capacity, but the only reason they have one principal, it's not because he's an autocrat, it's because the board doesn't want to spend the money on bloated administration. Mm-hmm. But again, this is incarnational, right? You directors of learning have to be equipped to be more than coaches, but coaching has to happen on a regular basis. And think about, again, the athlete analogy of the coaches I appreciated the most were not necessarily the ones that always told me that I was great. They were the ones that were there regularly helping me see that I didn't walk away from a game not understanding how that coach felt about how I played. Like if I got in a car, my parents said, how do your coach feel you played? Right. I'd feel better if they said, he said I played terrible, than if I had to say, I have no idea. I don't know. He doesn't say anything to me. So I think, again, this just, there are good systems out there to do this, but I still think it comes down to, we just have to sit and actually peel back. Mm-hmm. How do teachers experience the volume of interactions we have with them? And it could be, we don't have any, right? And when you're getting hammered in a volatile environment where parents feel comfortable sending you awful emails, and you're not hearing from your leader, then all you know is what I'm getting from this crazy parent who's ripping my head off every week. Does that make sense? That's part of the problem with all the volatility. And now we're not balancing that with enough other feedback. So again, that's probably not what you were looking for. I think it's just, I can't get out of, the older I get, what it actually meant that throughout all of God's redemptive history, he desired to be present with us. And how do we image that as leaders with teachers who are doing really, really difficult work in a very volatile age? And this struck me a few years ago when I read just the awfulest email from a parent that I actually respected and thought, this is a really good parent. This is a great mission fit. And this parent wrote an email to a teacher that was so over the top. That I thought, oh my goodness, if this person that I thought was this perfect mission fit for our school felt comfortable pushing send on this email to a teacher, how am I going to counterbalance that as a leader in the classroom? Because I don't want that teacher to stop. I'm not at this point going to kick that parent out of school. But you see what I'm saying? How do I create the capacity for that person to still function in that environment? That takes time and energy being present. And whether that's the principal or a director of learning or an instructional coach, we just have to be present in those spaces if we're going to attract and retain teachers.
Chad, we're going to start wrapping up here. Our friend Daryl DeBoer often uses an exit ticket. I used to think, but now I think, or now I know. So I'm going to start with teacher recruitment. If you think about your time in school leadership, I used to think teacher recruitment was about what? Now I think it's moved to what? So what did you used to think about teacher recruitment and what's changed?
Yeah, I used to think it was about putting your posting on the right posting boards. Now I think it's about developing relationships with people who will influence potential candidates to consider our school.
Mm-hmm. And could you do the same for teacher retention? I used to think it was about this.
Yeah, I used to think we just had to put a teacher in a classroom that they love to be in. And now I know we have to be daily intentional about supporting and developing them. And if we're not thoughtful about doing that every day, then we're not doing enough. I realize all the other pressures. I understand the tyranny of the urgent and the parent that comes in the door, but somehow we have to get back to teachers have to feel that their leaders can identify with their success and their struggle and can support them in it. And that again, that means telling them, no, don't do that again, do this. There's some of that too, but we have to find a way. And I'm preaching to myself there. That probably is in my leadership career, that probably was my greatest weakness.
Chad and listeners, we know your time is valuable and want to thank you for joining us today for another Hallway Conversations. Whether it's this day, this week, or this month, we hope the Lord gives you what you stand in need of And we want to send you from here with our blessings. So to our friends, may the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace and give you peace and give you peace. Amen. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for joining us, Chad. We hope you have a good week, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
This podcast was literally dreamed up during one of our actual hallway conversations. Our music is by Ethan Mulder. Hallway Conversations is created and produced by Matt Beamers, Abby DeGroat, and Dave Mulder. Hey, we have a favor to ask of you. Would you be willing to rate this podcast or write a review in your podcast app? Or if you found this conversation interesting or helpful, would you consider sharing it on your social media? Those things really do help podcasters out, and we would be so, so grateful. Thanks for listening, friends.
Great job, Mr. Dirksy.
Well, thanks for a little bad. There's four of us on the call, and one of us did a lot more talking than everybody else.
Wow, you're our special guest.
Listen, don't be so hard on yourself.